School has started, and a lot of students are having a hard time finding a seat. That's because state budget cuts across the country have meant teacher layoffs and larger class sizes. Take Los Angeles. Some high schools there have as many as 43 students in a class. So, will these kids learn less? Someone who has studied how big is too big is Jeremy Finn. He's a professor of education at SUNY Buffalo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, 43 sounds like a lot. Is that too big?
43 is too big, yes.
Too big, period.
Too big, period. There's just a point at which teachers can't really get to know the individual students, can't teach the materials. Students split off into splinter groups and withdraw from the classroom interactions, and 43 is well into that range.
So give us a rough ballpark for those kids from kindergarten through third grade and then higher. What are optimal class sizes, and what are class sizes you can live with?
The research has shown definitively that classes of under 20 students in kindergarten through third grade have all kinds of advantages. They increase both the academic and social engagement of students, and they increase learning. That's especially true for students at risk, that is, minority students, students from low-income homes, and students for whom English is a second language. In small classes, students' behavior changes even more than does teacher behavior.
How is student behavior different in small class sizes?
It's because every student is on what I would call the firing line. You can't hide in the back corner of the room. Students are better behaved. They pay more attention. They support each other in learning more. And their achievement scores go up. Furthermore, it's been shown that for children who are in small classes for 3 or 4 years, graduation from high school is more likely. Taking college entrance exams is more likely. So these early grades of small classes have long-lasting effects.
And by early grades, you're talking kindergarten through third grade.
That's correct.
I read an article recently in The New Yorker written by Malcolm Gladwell, and it talked a lot about teachers and class size. And I just want to read you a quote from him. He is skeptical that class size is as important as it's made out to be. He writes, "You have to cut the average class almost in half to get the same boost that you'd get if you switched from an average teacher to a teacher in the 85th percentile." So in essence, he's saying that teacher competency is better and more important to student achievement than class size.
I've heard that argument many times before. There really aren't data that make that comparison directly. But I would argue, and as I have many times, that what you want is both a good teacher and a small class. Imagine what a good teacher could do with a small class.
Are there any strategies, though, if parents are just faced with, you know, my kid is going to a high school with 43 kids in every class. What do I tell my son or daughter to do to get the best education possible in this situation?
I wish I had the answer to that, because I would tell every parent to do that. There are things a school can do, though, to help students at risk. And one thing is to make the students feel welcome, warmly received, and supported in their classes, even if the class is larger than you might like. As simple as the administrator standing at the front door of the school when kids arrive and greeting each kid and talking to them something about their school day or their morning. There actually is a research study on this that's shown that makes kids feel more warmly received.
Jeremy Finn is a professor of education at SUNY Buffalo, and we've been talking about the effects of large class sizes. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Dealing with the flu this winter looks to be more complicated than usual, and we have two reports this morning. But first, we'll hear about some of the concerns that the nation's seniors have when it comes to revamping existing health care. Nearly all of them have coverage under the government-run Medicare program, and they worry about losing benefits. In an effort to address those fears, the Obama administration put Vice President Joe Biden on the case. NPR's Julie Rovner has the report.
Biden traveled to Leisure World, a retirement community just outside Washington, D.C., and immediately charmed the audience of about 150 seniors. First, he offered to find an errant cell phone ringing at the bottom of someone's purse.
And I'll answer your phone. I can't find mine either. I don't know where the hell mine is.
Then, while Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius addressed the audience, Biden simply plunked himself down in the mostly female crowd, prompting this from the HHS secretary.
Mr. Vice President, you look right at home. Surrounded by beautiful women.
Of course, Biden's used to fielding questions from the senior crowd, including his 92-year-old mother. In fact, he said the last time he was home in Delaware.
I walk in, give her a kiss. She said, Joey, what about these death panels? And I said, Mom, I'm trying to kill you. She said, I'm serious, Joey. What about these death panels? I said, Mom, it's hokum. It's a bunch of malarkey. And then I explained it to her.
But joking aside, Biden was clearly there to speak to a much larger audience and to deliver a larger message. First, that Democrats, rather than Republicans, can be trusted to protect Medicare.
Just step back and ask yourself, what do you think? You know nothing else about the subject. You just know the guys who were against it the last 20 years are now telling you the guys who were fighting for it for the last 30 years are trying to get rid of it. Come on, man. Come on.
Biden also reminded seniors that they have a lot to gain from the bills now moving through Congress. More coverage of preventive care, lower payments for drugs, not to mention a shoring up of Medicare's finances. Back on Capitol Hill, however, Republicans like John Kyle of Arizona painted a whole different picture of what the bill now before the Senate Finance Committee would do to Medicare.
What senior wouldn't be concerned that cutting over $210 billion by cutting payments to hospitals and nursing homes and home health and hospice might not adversely affect their care?
And so the battle lines are drawn for the hearts and minds of America's seniors. And whoever wins this battle is likely to win the health care war. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Scientists have made a surprise discovery about our moon. It is generally thought to be bone dry. But now three new studies show that actually the lunar dirt holds stores of hidden water. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Nobody thought the surface of the moon was covered with water. Even the scientists who saw the first hints of water didn't believe it.
Like any normal person, you'd say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, it can't be there. It must be calibration problems.
Carly Peters says her team thought their instrument must be out of whack. They spent months looking at their data.
Arguing amongst ourselves what could be real, what could not be real, and it would not go away.
Peters works at Brown University. She heads up research with a NASA instrument called the Moon Mineralogy Mapper, which went up on a spacecraft built by India to orbit the moon. To make sure this mapper really had picked up water, the scientists got data from two other spacecraft that flew by the moon. It turns out those probes detected signs of water, too. But Peters says it's not the kind of water we normally think about here on Earth.
There's no oceans, there's no clouds, there's no lakes, there's no puddles. This is completely different.
You know, it's not your grandmother's water on the moon. It isn't. You sort of have to throw out everything you think of by that phrase.
Jessica Sunshine is a researcher at the University of Maryland in College Park.
It's not liquid water. It's not frozen water, and it's not gaseous water, okay? It's none of those things. What it is a very thin film, maybe several layers of molecules thick.
She says if you could scrape all the water molecules off an area about the size of a football field, you'd get maybe a quart.
And it could be a lot less. I think our understanding is not great.
Another thing that's not yet understood is the source of the water. It seems to come and go over the course of the lunar day as temperatures change. The new findings are being published this week by the journal Science. Carly Peters says it was amazing to discover a previously unknown dynamic process on our nearest celestial neighbor.
Nature surprises us, and in this case, the moon completely surprised us. This was something that we were not expecting.
One reason space enthusiasts are so interested in water on the moon is because of hopes that it could come in handy if astronauts ever go back. NASA has been working on new rockets and space capsules for a return by 2020. There's even talk of a lunar base. Those plans are all currently under review by the Obama administration. And at a press conference this afternoon, experts pointed out that the moon's surface still looks pretty dry, despite these new findings. Jim Green is director of NASA's Planetary Science Division.
Even the driest deserts in the Earth have more water than are at the poles and the surfaces, as we've presented here, of the moon.
Still, NASA hopes to find more water next month. Scientists had long assumed if the moon had any water at all, it would be frozen at the bottom of dark, cold craters. So in October, NASA will put a spent rocket part on a collision course with that kind of crater to see if the impact kicks up evidence of buried ice. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Filmmaker Michael Moore certainly knows how to pick his subjects. In 2007, Sicko got the jump on the current healthcare debate, and now Capitalism, A Love Story examines the causes of the recession. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
Capitalism, A Love Story is more than Michael Moore's latest documentary. It's the summation of the movies he's been making for the past 20 years. He lays all the ills of American society at the feet of an out-of-control free market system. He so detests it. He puts priests on camera to talk about capitalism as morally evil.
We're here to get the money back for the American people.
Moore has not lost his provocateur's gift for stirring the pot. But Capitalism, A Love Story misses the narrower focus that gave his earlier films some of their punch. Capitalism is such a huge topic that touching a wide variety of bases may be inevitable, but it's still distracting.
Fill it up. I got more bags. $10 billion probably won't fit in here. We want our money back!
That said, Moore's scattershot is a lot more interesting than some filmmakers' focus. He has not lost his zest for confrontational antics. He surrounds all of Wall Street with yellow crime scene tape to emphasize his low opinion of the area's activities. And he drives an armored car up to AIG corporate headquarters and demands the company return federal bailout funds. The main point Moore wants to make, the thing that drives him craziest, is his notion that capitalism is a scheme set up to make a profit on absolutely anything. It's a system, he says, that has turned American society into a culture that says money is the only value. Perhaps the most startling thing about capitalism is that Michael Moore stands revealed not as some pointy-headed socialist, but as an unreconstructed New Deal Democrat. He admires Franklin D. Roosevelt and feels that the decades-long weakening of unions has fatally weakened America. The fact that this will be a controversial stance says as much about today's political culture as it does about Moore's place in it.
To see clips from Michael Moore's latest film, go to NPR.org. Kenneth Turan reviews movies from Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Madeline Brand. America's best male alpine skier ever is headed back to the slopes. At 31 years old, Bodie Miller had considered retirement, but he announced today that he will return to competition and attempt to qualify for the Vancouver Olympics in February. Miller has two reputations, one for his talent, the other for being the sport's bad boy. And as NPR's Howard Berkus explains, his return raises both hopes and concerns.
Bodie Miller's comeback has the skiing world absolutely giddy.
Bodie Miller is the most interesting and dynamic character on the World Cup circuit.
Alan Abrahamson is the Olympic Insider columnist for UniversalSports.com.
And if you like skiing, the world is a lot more interesting when Bodie Miller is up there on the mountain. It just is. That's reality.
Miller hits 90 miles an hour in some events, racing hard on steep and icy slopes that can be difficult to stand on. He's won 31 World Cup events, more than any other American man, and he won two silver medals at the Salt Lake City Games. But the Torino Olympics in 2006 were a big disappointment. Miller seemed more interested in a gold medal and partying and before the games he admitted to skiing drunk. But 2008 was a fabulous year, as captured in this race in Switzerland by UniversalSports.com.
Bodie Miller blazing down the Lauberhorn on this Sunday afternoon into the final S-turn known as Stump Valley. Bodie over the last jump, and Miller at the line is into the lead by 1.3 seconds.
But then came the 2009 season and this early race in Colorado.
Well, getting a little wide there.
Whoa! And down he goes.
Oh, my.
Bodie into the netting.
And Bodie with an ankle injury that nagged at him all season, his worst ever. He quit the circuit a month before it ended and considered retirement. But time off and time to think made him realize, he says, that he can't stay away.
You enjoy your sport, you dedicate your life to it, and you can see how it would be nice to walk away and try something new. And then you walk away, and there's obviously a big hole left where that sport was. You know, especially in my case, it's my main form of expression.
Miller admits to having to work hard to get back into skiing shape, but Olympic writer Alan Abrahamson says Miller still has the capacity to be a superstar at the Vancouver Olympics.
If Bodie Miller is healthy and he qualifies for the Olympics, he is a medal contender in every event he qualifies for.
The comeback is with the U.S. ski team, which Miller abandoned 2 years ago when he formed his own team of coaches, trainers, and technicians. He didn't like ski team rules then, but today's news conference was a love fest between Miller and ski team coach Sasha Rierich.
Bodie's been, over the years, inspirational to a lot of us. And to have that attitude of always seeking more speed, part of the team, is really exciting for the coaches and the athletes.
But can Bodie Miller be a team player now, and will he behave? He intends to be positive, he said, and asks to be judged by his actions. Hank McKee covers alpine skiing for Ski Racing magazine, and he's optimistic because Miller's
not a young punk kid anymore. So let's hope there's a little maturity that's happened, and here we go.
Here we go to what some are now saying could be a much more interesting Olympics, no matter which Bodie Miller shows up. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
As we've been hearing this morning, world leaders are gathering in Pittsburgh today to try to nurture the global economy back to health, talk about their next steps. European leaders will be key in that. And this morning, Eleanor Beardsley takes a look at how Europe has been affected over the past year.
An economic crisis born in the USA soon washed up on European shores as real estate bubbles in Spain, the UK, and Ireland burst, and a few Belgian banks went under. Europeans quickly discovered just how many of their banks were holding Uncle Sam's toxic assets. As in the U.S., confidence waned and money dried up. But despite the many similarities, the crisis has played out differently in Europe because of its more conservative financial environment, says Paul Swaim, an economist with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD.
Europeans haven't felt it as early as Americans did. One reason for that is that the housing market in the U.S., of course, got way out of balance in the several years ago with subprime mortgages and so on. That didn't happen in most of Europe, because in most of Europe, banks are conservative. If you want to buy a house, you need a 30 or 40% down payment. And it's very rare that a European would take equity out of their house by refinancing a mortgage.
European banks have had other problems, says Swaim, like the German and Austrian banks that lent heavily to Eastern European nations, which are unable to repay their debt. One buffer against the raw edges of the crisis has been the continent's social safety net. Unemployment benefits in many countries last for up to 2 years and can provide up to 65% of one's salary. And even if you do lose your job, you don't lose your health care coverage. The main effect of the crisis has been unemployment, but the reaction to it has been much angrier here than in the U.S. In France, irate employees have kidnapped their bosses at companies like Caterpillar, 3M, and Sony to protest the layoffs. And recently, workers at a tire factory being shut down in eastern France brought their angry demonstrations to downtown Paris, burning tires in front of the stock exchange. Such actions may seem violent to Americans, but they have popular and even political support here. There is widespread feeling that swindlers and greedy traders started this crisis, but it's the working man who is paying the price. Tire factory worker Bertrand Lenoir sums up popular sentiment.
When you've been trahi une fois, deux fois, trois fois,
We've been betrayed, and they're trying to pull one over on us. But we're not idiots. The way we workers will survive this crisis is to unite and show these people that they rolled the dice and lost. And they're the ones who are going to pay for this crisis, not us.
Even though unemployment has risen in most European countries, the increase hasn't been as steep as in the U.S. That's because many governments here have taken an active role in saving jobs, says the OECD's Swaim. For example, German GDP has fallen 4% over the last year as its export markets dwindled, but unemployment has only gone up 1%.
What that means is lots of German employers are keeping on workers even though they don't really need that many workers to keep production going. One reason for that is that the German government, in fact, provides quite large subsidies to employers if instead of laying off workers, what they will do is put their a large workforce on part-time instead.
Such measures to tide a country over during a downturn can be successful if the recession doesn't last too long, say economists. And there are already signs that the crisis may be waning. The continent's two largest economies, Germany and France, showed modest growth between April and June and have officially pulled out of recession. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.